Okay, this is called, what lesson is it called? Lesson 9. This is actually the 16th week, but it's lesson 9. That's not bad. What did I do, skip some? But anyway, lesson 9 for those who might be coming online to the website. And we're going to talk today about the book of Revelation. Now, the interesting thing is that this book can be studied in so many different ways. For example, I have one of my favorite commentary sets on Revelation is in what's known as the Word Biblical Commentary, which is a bit of an advanced commentary. It's 3 volumes. And that 3-volume set, except maybe in the introduction, won't even talk about what we're going to talk about this evening. It just deals with the details of the book. This book has so many allusions to historical things, whether it's something in the Old Testament or whether it's using the word Jezebel, which must have been a problem in the New Testament. It is so full of Old Testament nuances, and yet never one time in the book of Revelation does it directly quote the Old Testament. This is one of the strange things about the book. So we could study it just to get the details and what these images mean. Most of these images are, not all of them, but from time to time pop up like in the Old Testament. And so you can go back and you can compare the metaphors and the similes and so forth. The animals like in the book of Daniel, these beasts out of the sea and so forth. So you could go at it just going for those details, not trying to figure out anything, whether the book is saying anything about the future, but that it's talking more generally. You can outline the book. It's not too hard to outline, actually, in terms of chapters. It's actually an epistle. 1:1-8 is the intro. And then chapter 1:9 through the end of chapter 3:21 are the 7 churches. Chapter 4 actually, all the way through chapter 21:8. Has all of this material about seals and bowls and the angels flying back and forth and all the things that go on in the book that get our curiosities and make it difficult for us to understand what's going on. That we'll just call that the main body. And 19 to 21, which is really part of the main body, we'd have to take it down this way. I said 19:11. What did I do here? I went all the way to the end of it. I already included the world's final judgments. Then in 21:9-22:5, we've talked about some of, Bob's talked about some of this in Sunday school. We kind of have the closing view of this rejuvenated world. We'll just call it the new heaven and earth. And then there's an epilogue right at the very end, 22:6-21, which is the closing, just like an epistle. So we have a big epistle that's quite different than most of the letters, obviously. It's more general. In fact, they call this a general epistle. And we have the signs of an epistle with the introduction and the closing. And then we have 7 epistles internal to those first 4 chapters, 7 letters. Because of what we're doing, I've already given this away. But lots of times you could ask people in a general setting, What are Jesus' last words to the church? What would most people say when you ask them that question? Jesus' last words to the church. Without your being conditioned, be what? Great Commission, yes. The end of the Gospels, the beginning of the book of Acts. I think most would respond that way if you weren't in Revelation or didn't have it already triggered in that direction. But the reality is, the book of Revelation, almost all the views, although they'll date it differently, will see this book as one of the last books written for the New Testament period. And the words of Jesus to the church are not particularly pretty in these seven churches. We could do nothing this evening, and we wouldn't even have time to do it, just break down the seven churches and see what Jesus said to them, see which ones didn't get a good rap. What was one of the ones that got called out particularly? The church of Laodicea. Everybody seems to know that. You're lukewarm. What was the church that really got high praise, but they'd lost their first love? Ephesians, yeah. And so this is a great study. In fact, there are books written just on this section of these seven churches. And you know what's very interesting about these is there's so much historical material that you've got to get into the first century and the period in which it was written to get the idea of what the author is referring to. What are his analogies? Who is this Jezebel? What's Nicolaitans is another one. There's all kinds of names that you've got to check out and trace. A good Bible dictionary would help you, as we talked about very early in our time in hermeneutics. So that's the book in a nutshell, but let's start thinking about it in some other ways. Robert Mounts, who wrote a commentary on Revelation, makes this comment on the top of your notes. It is difficult to say what anything means about the book of Revelation until one has decided, in a sense, what everything means. Everybody kind of gets stalled when they get to Revelation. And even in Daniel, they'll get stalled, even though Daniel's mostly a historical book. But when they get into the images and the visions of the animals and so forth, they get stalled. People get stalled at the book of Revelation. And here's the reason. Because if you don't understand the whole thing about the book of Revelation, and you jump into the details of the book of Revelation, you'll be overwhelmed, and you won't have any reference for what does this stuff mean. Now, tonight, I want to give you a paradigm, and this is just one way in which we can look at this book. It's probably the most interesting way to people because it addresses some of the curiosities about how Revelation fits the future particularly. But we're going to look at it from what I call the butlers that unpack the book of Revelation. And there's going to be four of these butlers that we're going to talk about. And all of the literature on the book of Revelation will fit into one of the butlers. And even these days, there's a little bit of overlap between the butlers. There didn't used to be quite as much, but now there's a little bit of overlap, and you have to get into a lot of the details to see that sort of thing. So this is just one aspect of how we can study the Revelation, but I think that it will help you to get some bearings on this book. The first one is they're under the survey of four systems, four butlers that unpack the book. The first one is called the Church Age Historical. This view dominated a lot of Western culture thinking on the Bible by people that were trying to unscrew the inscrutable, so to speak. But it died out, and it really isn't in the ballgame anymore. But it's a very important view to take thought of. Now, some of you who are in my category of age, you remember Albert Barnes' notes, Barnes' notes? Most of you wouldn't have known these, but they were, you see, there wasn't a lot of good biblical-based literature for conservative people back in 40 years ago, 50 years ago. When I started school, when I was young, at a young age, 66, I'd been in the Navy 4 years, got out, went to a Bible college. You could not find what I would call an evangelical commentary on most of the books of the Bible. You could find things like Arnside. You could find things like Alan Redpath. You could find things like Oliver B. Green. And these were great men, but that literature is not literature that you want to use to figure out the Bible. It's literature that is telling you Christian beliefs, but it wasn't really a biblically based study sort of thing. It was what Oliver thought about the Bible, what Arnside thought about the Bible. Very pious stuff. And that was an era in which piety was the test more than whether you can demonstrate that's what the text means. If you had a good pious line, you were home free. J. Oswald Chambers, some of you may use his literature and devotions. Mystic, spiritualist to some extent, Christian, of course. But don't take it to the bank if he tells you what a verse means. He'll bless your soul, but don't let him bless the Bible, by and large. And there's a lot of that kind of literature. And unfortunately, you're cursed with it because the bookstores sell you these things and it has a reputation from the past. But not the best thing to go to. The church historical, Albert Barnes was a scholar. But in the book, and he has a lot of good material in other books, but in the book of Revelation, he strictly followed the historical view. You should have that book, for example, just because it is the example of what they were thinking. Let me show you in the notes here. Down under A, definition. The book of Revelation provides a sequential, symbolic forecast of the whole course of human history from the time of John until the end of history. That was their premise. The description, the church age historical system, no longer a contender. It was Albert Barnes's material. For example, the first seal, the white horse, was interpreted by them to be the peace and prosperity in the Roman Empire from Domitian, 96, to Commodus in AD 180. Golden age, in a sense, where Rome had everything under control and there weren't a lot of problems. The fifth seal, they put to Diocletian's efforts to extinguish Christians in 284 to 304. Now, see, Christianity was not a legal religion until about 325 or so. And so they were being heavily persecuted at this time. And they're saying that the Bible predicted these things. John predicted these things. And they click it off historically. The first trumpet is the invasion of the Roman Empire by Alaric, king of the Goths, in 395 to 410. The angel in the little scroll, the angel announces victories of the Reformation, and the little book is the agent of the victory, the Bible, chapter 10. And the claim is this is exact historical correlation. Then the beast of chapter 13 is the civil and secular power of Rome and the papacy. Anybody who grew up in my generation, the Pope was basically the Antichrist. I mean, that was the way it was thought. And you got the seven hills around Rome, and all these things are correlated with the text. And you have to see Albert Barnes's notes to see the detail. I mean, it's a lot of detail, and it looks very impressive on the surface. The first vial or bowl, the French Revolution. And the seventh, the complete overthrow of the papacy. But Barnes ends right there because of why? It hadn't happened yet. He had nothing else to say about history because he got to the end of the sequence that he correlated. And so therefore, the view just stopped because there's nothing else about history, and yet they claimed that it was so one-to-one analogy up until that time. Well, as a result, we know now that that was one of the most creative presentations of the book, but not one to follow. Some analysis of that. This view is creative but limited by an author's own time and world. Proponents only know of the Western world, furthermore, and do not align events beyond about 1800. Little unanimity between those who follow this system. They had their own inward battles, as all views do, about what each passage may have been meant to correlate with. Three, most time statements have to be revised to allow for correlations with events. Days and months become years to make it work out. And they got very creative on that score. Explanatory insets in the book of Revelation creates sequence problems. When you read the whole book, you'll find there's an inset here and an inset here where it seems to stop and you get a little narrative and then you move on. But that messes up if you want it to be an actual sequence in history. The beast persecutes witnesses before his rise to power. Babylon falls in 14, but it doesn't fall yet until 17 and 18. So there's some interesting pieces to the book in that regard. This view came late in church history. It was traced to about 1200 by Joachim of Florus, and Barnes picked it up and made it famous in his own way. So that's the historical system. It correlates with the ages and the events that were happening in the Western world, particularly the English and the European Western world. America is not even factored in to these things in terms of fulfillment. Everybody tries to get America slipped in there somehow these days, but not with this. Then the next view. The next view is called the idealist. This is probably the dominant view of the book. Notice what the idealists say under the definition. I've written this out for you, and I'm going to read it, but it helps you later. Revelation presents the timeless spiritual truths of the struggle of good and evil through symbolic language, but it does not tie any statement to a specific historical event, and there is no predictive prophecy in any historical sense. All right? Well, I can't say it much clearer than that. So the idealist is seeing the great battle between good and evil. And apocalyptic, that's the word we use when it gets kind of dicey with the animals and the battles and the sky turning to blood and all those kinds of things. We call that apocalyptic literature. And the book of Revelation has a good piece of that, like the book of Daniel does. And so when people come to that, they want to ascribe literal meaning to it. The idealists say, no, that would be overdue. That it is it's the constant, forever great battle between good and evil. And you see the good put down from time to time by the evil, and sometimes God gets the evil under control. But it is an eternal battle that will go on until Jesus comes. All the views believe Jesus will come. It's just a matter of when. And so the idealists are that way. Most of the commentaries, the best commentaries, fall into this idealist category. So you can see, like I mentioned, there was a three-volume set by Aune, A-U-N-E, and he is describing all of this language, correlating it with other literature like the Old Testament and the intertestamental Jewish literature to describe and help people to understand what these figures of speech are portraying, but never using it as a map to eschatology or the future or predictive prophecy or anything like that. And that's the majority, pretty much, of the church. Which millennial view do you think this group would hold? I probably say it in here, but I'll get ahead of myself. Which millennial view do you think they would hold? The all-millennial view. Because there really isn't a millennium, like we in the historical sense. It's just when God actually reigns on earth, you have periods of peace. And so all millennialism is idealist in their view. Description. The idealist position utilizes the symbolic speech of Revelation to unpack, notice this, underline it, timeless truths about God and evil. And here's the thing. They nail it. They're right. Because what are they doing? They're just telling you what biblical imagery means. We're putting together a library for the church, and we ordered a dictionary on biblical imagery. You could go in there and look up a lot of things in the book of Revelation and get a half a page or something to tell you what this means. It's imagery. And so I have idealist commentaries on Revelation because they do the best job explaining to me those connections and the meaning of these images. They just don't connect it to history other than the great battle of timeless truth between good and evil. Here's a quote. In Revelation, words take the place of pigments and brushes to create a portrait designed to visualize great principles, not particular instances. Now, for most of your traditions, and Bob's, as he's been doing in Sunday school, would be what we call futurist. And that would grate against the futurist pretty heavily. No particular incidences are in view under the idealist model. John is calling the church to endure, to live for a sovereign God who will overcome evil eventually. Now, here's the thing, in the great metaphor of the Bible, from Genesis to the prophets to John and Jesus, the Gospels, and then on to the book of Revelation, you've got the same story from Genesis, the beginning, to the prophets. Guess what the prophets use? They use apocalyptic language because it seems like the end ought to come, but it's not here. But we don't have any more answers. God's going to have to deliver us at the end of the day. Same thing happens here. The book of Revelation basically gives the same message. At the end of the New Testament sequence, but from Genesis to Revelation, you got the same story. Only history will only be corrected and will be consummated when God himself takes charge. It'll never happen by godly people. As far as the great battle between good and evil is concerned. And futurists would basically say that too, but they would be in a different kind of context when they said it. So such presupposition or propositions are biblically true. They'll give you lots of great Bible information, but they don't connect it to any particular historical issue. And for me, when I study the book of Revelation, I believe there are some particular historical issues. Not as many as I used to think, but there are certainly enough to hold that. But in such a system, but question now, bottom page two, is such a system adequate in light of how Revelation brings the whole canon to a conclusion? Were the Old Testament prophets mere idealists, or did they forecast real future events in earth history? Now there you can, the rubber can hit the road, because we can talk about Jesus coming, his birth and a few things that the Old Testament particularly predicted. And then the New Testament writers use the Old Testament analogically to talk about other things like Nazareth and so forth. Here's a telling quote at the top of page three. We are not to look, the idealist says, in the apocalypse for special events, but for an exhibition of the principles which govern the history both of the world and the church. So the idealists are super Bible students on the timeless truths, on the concept of evil, on the concept of good. But they're not in any sense prophetic. We'll just have to wait for that to come. And so they don't see any particular historical events involved in Daniel or in the book of Revelation, for that matter. Now, here's some examples. Examples of certain forms of idealism. For example, here's a quote from Robert Wall, who has a commentary that takes an idealist view. The setting of this scene, this is in I'm doing Revelation 16 and 17, or the fall of Babylon, to give you an illustration. The setting of this scene is the mythic city-state Babylon. While a map of ancient Rome may help us recognize the city John envisions, Babylon is actually the global village of godless power which determines daily life for every person at any time in human history. Well, when I think about politicians, I think that thought. You see, that is a beautifully worded way of capturing evil in the world. Don't expect good, because you won't get it from fallen sinners. The description of Babylon and its punishment is an impression of social evil and its destiny. It's not saying anything particular. That the fall of Wall Street or whatever would be the fall of Babylon. They're just saying that the fall of Babylon images how evil will eventually come to an end. That's the idealist position. And it's true, but is there historical particularity anywhere? That becomes the question. The next point, the great city Babylon, quote, stands for civilized man. Man in organized community, but man ordering his affairs apart from God. Now, that'll preach. It symbolizes the pride of human achievement, the godlessness of those who put their trust in man. I mean, you can look at almost any governmental situation, and that's what Babylon is representing, and say that, and be right, forever. Never fear contradiction. And that's what the idealists do. And they can surface all kinds of texts in the Bible that will say the same thing, because the Bible does portray evil in this manner and it does portray good in another manner. That's Leon Morris, by the way, who's a fine writer of commentaries. Over 1 million books in circulation from Leon Morris. He was a one-eyed Australian who was raised in the outback of Australia, educated by correspondence with the University of London, and became a famous Bible scholar, respected at all levels, and a prolific author. The best commentary on the book of John is by Leon Morris, one of the best commentaries, I think. Leon Morris. It's right here in the notes, page 3, middle of the page, the quote. But in Revelation, he's an idealist. All righty, the next one, Babylon, then. Quote, this comes from another writer showing you what idealist writers say. Babylon then is the world as the center of seduction at any moment of history. I could sing at this point. There's no business like show business, like no business we know. Everything about it is so exciting. You know? Well, better. Someone wanted to know, you who are listening, how that sounded in bluegrass. And I said, better. All right. Now, I shouldn't do those kinds of things. So it's the center of seduction at any moment in history. And the world looks that way, doesn't it? Even Moses talks about those kinds of things, and we often use the illustration of a tapestry. On one side, it's beautiful. On the other side, it's a mess of tangled strings. Sin always looks good in front of it. But when you get to the other side, all of a sudden you come to realize that what was promised and what you thought doesn't work. Brief analysis. Idealism provides many valid theological insights into the nature of God and evil, but it does not adequately account for specific historical reference, such as Christ culminating history within a specific space-time continuum. Revelation 20 is merely viewed as the church's potential to reign with Christ in this age. See, there's your millennial thing. It's only the potential, but it is not a real historical event. So, let me go on. Idealism number 2 at the bottom of page 3 was introduced by Clement and Origen in Alexandria, Egypt. This is a very early view of things. Idealism promotes the all-millennial view. Idealism overworks apocalyptic genre and ignores Revelation's claims to prophecy. There is prophecy and apocalyptic in the book of Revelation. So there are passages that are their troublesome passages, just like everybody has some. And you'd have to get into a rather elaborate study, as you can imagine, to see which of those texts that they have to battle. Now, you can do that. Another plug for an eventual library. Until this thing is set up, nothing's going to get checked out because we want to keep control of where things are and what's going on. But we ordered a bunch of what these things I've been mentioning called view books. And in there will be a view book on the millennium, and there'll be a view book on the book of Revelation. There's an absolutely excellent one on the book of Revelation that lays a lot of this stuff out. All right, number four, idealism overworks apocalyptic genre. Okay, five, idealism views defending or debating its views to be a waste of time. You can't engage them because why? It's about the great battle of good and evil. And like I say, there's a lot of compelling pieces to that, a lot of accurate pieces to that. It all just comes down to that one question. Where are texts that we think have a particularity to them about the future? And that's where it comes. And other systems will put those on the table. So that's the idealist view. So the historical view is passé. The idealist view is forever. Because it's that great battle between good and evil. And there's lots of good commentaries on Revelation. I suppose probably have more idealist commentaries than futurists because there are more idealist scholars than futurists. And so therefore, great information about the Bible, and it's a literal, veritable Bible study, but that question of historical events. The preterist. Now, this is a word that's not too common for you, I'm sure. What did I do with my thing? There it is, preterist. This is the word that's used in the literature for this particular aspect, this butler to unpack the book. The definition for the preterist: Revelation is exclusively focused on the problem of the first century. In other words, its limited view in history is the first century. And its predictive element has already been fulfilled. Now, they mean that absolutely. Especially in events such as the AD, I put that ADCE so you can be reminded of it, the 70 destruction of Jerusalem. The destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD satisfies the preterist absolutely for the details of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25, for the details of the horrible stuff in the book of Revelation. And indeed, it was a horrible event. It's hard to image this, how many Jews were crucified on the hills around the city of Jerusalem. They were just absolutely decimated by the Romans, and particularly because of their resistance to Rome's power. Now, let's think about some description here on page four. Did you hand out those little charts? Mm-hmm. We're not there yet, but we will be. It's in addition to the notes. It's a late addition. I got a lot of stuff packed up. I couldn't pull out some things I wanted, yeah. No, it sounds like a clever way of being an all-millennialist, or a post-millennialist almost has that same idea. That, yes. Yeah. But that view is going to have to be packaged in one of these four butlers. It can't be on its own because that's one piece of the whole thing. These four butlers, and the three particularly, are very comprehensive about where people are going to fall and how they read and interpret the book of Revelation. So this gives you about as good a overview as is possible. Okay, description 1A. The preterist view stresses that Revelation was fully relevant to the first generation of Christians which read it. They probably, the preterists would hate this, they probably used it like a newspaper. They shouldn't use the book of Revelation like a newspaper, predicting things. But that's almost what's being said. In fact, that is stressed to the point that its value for later generations is restricted to seeing past fulfillment and having only the brief single event of the second coming of Christ in the future. And here's a statement from Ken Gentry. He's a friend of mine. We were in school together. He is the probably international representative of postmillennialism. He's written 30, 40 books. And here's what he says. Here's his quote. And I think this captures the preterist. The closer we get to the year, and of course this was written in his book a long time ago, the closer we get to the year 2000, put it out in the future now, the farther we get from the events of the book of Revelation. That really nails it for the preterist. That's a graphic statement that what they view the Revelation as is a document portraying what happened in relation to the end of the first century, particularly the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And that would relate to the Olivet Discourse as well from Jesus. And, of course, Jesus did talk about, you know, go out to Petra. That's what we figure out that it means. And get out of town. And the interesting thing is, we'll mention futurism in a moment. They have done a lot of revising so that in the book of Revelation, there are pieces that do reflect what happened in the first century. They're almost undeniable. And that's one of those kinds of pieces that has almost like a double meaning, where the first century Christians fled because Rome's coming, and also the end of time Christians are to flee the what's happening, or the people of the earth. There is another problem in itself. Which ones are we talking about, depending on the time frame and your view of where the church is? See, this stuff is complicated. That's why it's hard. And the only way to get something uncomplicated is to know what all the options are. And these four views are your foundation to this. And if you read and reread this and think about it, I think you can get it under your belt. Two, the preterist view the beast as Rome and the harlot of Revelation 17 as Jerusalem. Thus, the AD 70 destruction of Jerusalem is what is described in chapter 17 of the book of Revelation. They would elaborate on what happened in that event in 70 AD from the content of chapter 17. The main tenets of this system appear in 1614 with a Jesuit priest, Alcazar. I don't know anything about him, but he was there. Number three, brief analysis. The preterist view requires an early date for the book of Revelation. Now think about it. If you're talking about the book of Revelation being a up to 70, and then giving you details about that, and then somebody comes along and says, hey, it wasn't written until the 90s. It won't work. So they and Ken wrote a dissertation on the dating of the book of Revelation and dated it back here. It's there are some people who do date it back there. He had an agenda, obviously, called postmillennialism, to date it back before 70. Now, the Gospels would be dated before that, the Olivet Discourse, but put the book of Revelation back there so that it becomes a kind of a foundation and a help to the Christians who are going through the horrible. It actually runs from 66 to 70. It's called the Great War, 66 to 70, where Rome comes down and decimates Palestine. So that requires an early date. So you got to be able to get that to get this view. For the preterist, AD 70 becomes the key event to explain Revelation's predictions. If the early date is shown to be invalid, this view encounters some pretty major problems. Liberals who hold this view usually hold the late date, but they're not that worried about it anyway. So what difference does it make? 2A, most preterist interpreters hold a post-millennial explanation. So idealists are all millennial. Preterists are post-millennial. This Christian Reconstructionist position has the church introducing the millennial conditions through the triumph of the gospel and the law of God, that eventually we will overcome and bring the world to its knees and to Jesus. Now, that takes a lot of faith, frankly, to be able to do that. But Ken writes on it with great detail. 3, preterists fail to deal adequately with the detailed claims of Revelation in regard to the final events of earth history. A quote from Tenney, or at least a statement by him. Because there are enough places where it seems to be implying some historical particularity to just get rid of that or to relegate it only to 70 becomes a problem. Now, the postmillennialists, they were pretty popular, but not now. They're a small bunch, but they're strong. And I have fun with Ken. He even likes the banjo. He's a good guy. All right, now, the futurist. And this is where most of your traditions are. Although the Southern Baptists, as a denomination, by my experience, I'm not a historian of the SBC, but by my experience and observations, particularly in the 60s and 70s, was that the Southern Baptist Church was primarily all millennial and also Arminian. You didn't hear a lot about it, but that was basically where they were. I don't know how Tom Askell views all that. I know they've got a different... they're using some different things and some different models, but it would be fun to see some historians debate these things. Okay. Why did I even say that?
The futurist.
Okay. I was just comparing. Okay. The futurist is particularly strongly a part of American fundamentalism and the early aspects of evangelicalism. Evangelicalism has always been pluralistic in these eschatological ways. But early fundamentalism, in fact, fundamentalism really got started as a result of prophetic conferences. So we got the futurist as number 4. There was a set of conferences, and you can look this up on the internet, the Niagara prophecy conferences. These were early 1900s. I'm not sure if they crept back into the 1800s. And then the Niagara, when all this was going on, there was a set of books written in 1909 called The Fundamentals. Because old-time liberalism had made such an invasion into mainline denominations. And most of the authors of those books called The Fundamentals wore their collars backwards. They were the G. Campbell Morgans and a lot of English conservatives. In the first presidents of Moody Bible Institute were Episcopalians. They weren't Baptists, and they weren't Bible Church. It didn't even exist yet, the Bible Church movement. And so, but the Niagara conferences focused on the thing of eschatology. And what happened is because there was such a strong non-futurist element in the larger Christian community, it just, like a bowling ball hitting the pins, broke apart the unity that the American Christian scene had, because the all-millennialists aren't going to go along, and whatever post-millennialists might have been there are not going to go along with the new futurist rage. And futurism and the prophecy conferences and what we call fundamentalism, which is more cultural than theological many times, excuse me, began to have its inroads. The rest is history, as they say. Excuse me, I'm sorry for you who are listening. That's one of the downsides of that little thing. Yeah, just be careful now what you edit, Josh. You know? All righty, now, look at the definition of futurism, bottom of page 4. Revelation 4:1 to 22:21 is almost exclusively predictive prophecy of a brief time period, about 7 years, and you have to go on to get the millennium in there, just prior to the second advent of Christ and the establishment of his thousand-year reign on earth. So that was the early futurism. If you get this book on the four views on the book of Revelation, I think they have two views on futurism in there, because futurism is the only of the all these views. Futurism is the only one that has what I would say grown. Growth means change. And there's different ways to illustrate this, and most of you won't get this. I'll just say it. But Dallas Theological Seminary has been one of the strongest evangelical conservative seminaries in the U.S. for, I don't know how long, a long, long time. And there is the old Dallas and there is the new Dallas. The old Dallas would far half of the new Dallas along some of these lines, I suppose, unless they would have grown along with them. In fact, the hero of some of the old things is Charles Ryrie, whom I think is still alive, and he would be an old-timer in these things, whereas the newer faculty, Bach and Blazing particularly, who have gone into this, have created some new paradigms. I think they're better paradigms because they found they listened to the Bible a little better. A lot of that earlier stuff was listening to a paradigm, to a view that they had to find in the Bible, rather than ask the Bible, what are you saying? And then the view emerges from that. Now, of course, those who hold that view probably wouldn't think that way. But I think historically, that's exactly the kinds of things that have happened. I am not an eschatological person, so I don't have a lot of detail on that. And at my stage in life, I'm not going to get that detail. And so, nonetheless, it's a big issue. So when we come to futurism and the futurist category, it's no longer monolithic. Now just for the sake of argument, I'll talk about futurist A and futurist B and futurist C. That doesn't have anything to do with these issues of the church and the rapture idea. That just has to do with the basic idea of getting into the book of Revelation. Because this would have been the old group. And the newer groups are seeing much more of 70 AD. And some of the explanations that are in there, because they go back to the Gospels. Some of the statements in the Gospels can't be pushed out. And you get into that kind of detailed study, and all of a sudden, you've got to stop and say, look, am I making the Bible fit my paradigm, or am I trying to find the Bible's paradigm for this? And the four views on the book of Revelation will unpack a lot of that if you happen to be highly interested in it. Some description. Futurists stress Revelation 1:1, 1:19, and 4:1. These are worth reading. Revelation 1:1, the revelation from Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. Now, that fits the preterist, you see, 70 A.D. But you got to date the book before 70 A.D. to have that privilege. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw. That is, these visions that he had. But that all the composite of those visions make up the revelation of the end time. That seems to have some historical particularity to it by the futurist mindset. Furthermore, 1:19. Write, therefore, what you have seen, what is now and what will take place later. The mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. And then it goes on. You see, idealist has less problems than the postmillennialists and the futurist have against each other when it comes to reading these and asking the questions about historical particularity. I should say that the other way around. The postmillennialist and the futurist will put it at a different time, but they both are saying that it's future. But the preterists date the book of Revelation back before that event so that they can then say it's predictive. whereas the futurists see it as predictive of something off down into the future. There's a lot of interesting things. I mean, this stuff is so huge. For example, if you go back in the book of Isaiah and read some texts, or even go into the book of Luke, for that matter, where Jesus is preaching at Nazareth the first time, he stops right in the middle of a verse in Isaiah, according to the way Luke presents that sermon. And where he stops is at the end of the first coming. Whereas if you were to read Isaiah, Isaiah takes the first coming and the second coming and talks about them in the same sentence without giving any indication of time. And yet, it was almost as if Jesus was saying, this is where we are now, and he stops right there in a reading, right in the middle of it, rather than going on. Little things like that that pop up all over the place that cause us and have caused futurists to say, well, there's got to be some particularity going on here. 4:1. After this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven, and a voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, come up here. Well, if it's a trumpet, right? And I will, everybody tries to make the voice of God sound like some actor with a deep voice. And this was an angel. And I will show you what must take place after this. 4:1 begins what most feel is the prophetic aspect of the book. And it's addressing the church of the first century up until that point. And then it's addressing the church by talking about what is yet to come. So futurists stress these passages along with a prophetic reconstruction of chapters 4 to 22. Now, the little handout that I gave you, this is a convenient little handout to show you how a futurist views the book. Okay, I don't like many of the charts. There was an old guy named Larkin that put out a chart book on dispensationalism and all these kinds of things. And you can put it into a museum. But anyway, here's the revelation of Jesus Christ, the futurist view of the structure. And you can see that chapter 1 is the introductory vision. Chapters 2 and 3 are the churches, which is still first century, evaluating at the end of the first century the state of the church, which wasn't really that pretty. And then chapter 4 and 5 is the introductory vision of what's coming. And then you've got these, what they call, premillennial judgments, where you've got the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, and how they sequence. And you see those things at the bottom in the squares, the two companies, the open book. See how the arrows go up? Those are known as insets. Those chapters are inset and delays like the seal, the last seal coming. And you notice it comes at the end of each of these, the last seal, the next to the last seal, the next to the last woe and the trumpets, and then at the very end of the bowls. So they sort of are narrative glue telling you some story, but not explaining the seals at that point. It's very consistent the way it does that. Now here, you get into all kinds of issues. Some people will say that the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls are all the same. And that they're and then this view is more sequential, as you can see by the chart. So when you get into this technical study of the book of Revelation, you're going to get into a lot of different details about how to view these. So what I'm saying is just try to get down the big paradigm, and then you can work out from there as to what's going on.
Isn't it where the pre-trib rapture comes from, that the church is not mentioned after chapter 4?
Well, that's what's claimed, yes. Mm-hmm. And I've generally been premillennial, generally been viewed the church as going somewhere, but I've frankly given up on that part of it. I just think it's futile. A lot of, fundamentalism early on was all pre-trib, yes. And they blamed the Scofield Bible for all that, mostly. And but then we had variations come along. I've got a few stories on that. One guy wrote a famous book on post-trib, and he was sitting behind me in a professional meeting and told his friend he did it as a term paper. Thing ended up being a book that split the church. But whatever. And so, yeah, it just, that thing about the church becomes a bit of a booger in the whole mess. There was something I wanted to put in right there. Number one, there is no prophecy that's going to tell you when a rapture is going to take place. A lot of people say, well, look at the earthquakes and look at the floods and look at all that. That doesn't have anything to do with it. And the very next prophetic thing that will happen in the sequence of earth history is Jesus coming. Now the question is, which coming? Okay. But that's the next thing. So anybody who says there are signs of the rapture don't have a clue what they're talking about. They've just denied the very thing of the rapture, for that matter, like a thief in the night. And so there is more junk and more heat than light when you get into these particular domains. And controlling the broad spectrum of views is a monster, to be sure. And that's not been a passion of mine, frankly. All right, because these are creative constructs. Remember our triangle a long time ago? These are all creative constructs. There is not one proof text for most of the views. They'll claim text, and it makes sense to them, but it doesn't make sense to anybody else. And so the fact is you've got to be very cautious about these things. They are not a test of faith, for sure. Millennium, raptures, and things of that matter. Then the millennium comes. I hope that's right. I want to lay down with the lambs and the snakes and all that stuff. But I won't be here because the church is removed. The church doesn't enter the millennium if you take a standard sort of futurist idea of this. The church is in heaven and comes back at the end of it. But here again, well, which view? That's just been the common ideas that I have sort of absorbed, but I have never tried to prove any of that. Postmillennial judgment at the end of chapter 20, the introductory vision to the eternal state and the heaven and earth. That's another question in our last minute or two is this question of heaven and earth. Is it a rejuvenated planet or is it a brand new planet? I think that most would see it as a rejuvenated planet. God's original creation was never intended to be the way it is now. And he's going to fix that. Okay. Now, I can't go through, because of time, all the definition and descriptions. This is the view you would know the best, and you can read these. But I want to mention one book here. I've mentioned under E, Marvin Pate, Four Views on the Book of Revelation. If you really want to study the Book of Revelation, get that book. It's not big. And there's four views, so you only have one-fourth of the book you have to read immediately. One view, you know, you just keep chopping it down here. And that's a great book on getting yourself into the Book of Revelation, because that book's not designed about all the niceties of all the systems. It's asking about the Book of Revelation. Now, this is another book, and we've ordered this one, or will order it soon. This book is the book that I mentioned, and I see that it's been revised, and I'm not, I'd have to go in and look a little harder. The first edition of it was not a good edition because the weakest column was the futurist. It didn't have good sources. But I think he's changed some of it because the last printing of this was about 20, 30 years after the first printing. And I worked mostly from the first printing. So I'm optimistic that perhaps some of that was, I see David Clark mentioned, who wasn't around in the first printing. So, but what they do is they go through every one of these passages. You've probably got all kinds of, you got passages that you want to know something about. You'll say, well, what about that beast? Okay, go to chapter 13. And you have four columns. Guess what they are? Historicist, preterist, futurist, and he calls it spiritual, bad choice. It's the idealist. He calls it spiritual, but it's the idealist. I don't like the order of this, but that's, I guess he did it because of history. The preterists are historical. Probably should have put the futurist last. If by my memory, this fellow is an idealist. And in the first edition, I thought he took pot shots at the futurists because of the sources he used. But now I think he's got it straightened out a little better. So satisfy your curiosity. You know, curiosity is the path to learning. And if you're not curious and you can be satisfied with simple stuff, then so be it for you. But if you want to learn, be curious, and go look up some of this stuff. See what it says. See how it compares. That is your best entree to the book of Revelation. So if you had that Four Views book, little paperback, and you had this, you're on your way to becoming an expert on the book of Revelation. All right? Then you can tell me, because I'm not going to become an expert on the book of Revelation. Great book, though. We're told to read it and to be encouraged by it. And the idealist will certainly achieve that for you. And the futurist will confuse you and get you all upset as to which one is going to happen. Okay, that's oversimplification, but nonetheless, those butlers are the key to getting into the book. All right, well, I'm about right on time with when we actually started. You can have any questions. I'm sure there's all kinds of questions, but the way to answer questions is to do work. There's just no shortcuts here on anything, for that matter. Yes, all the views believe in the ultimate second coming of Christ. But the question is, well, and what happens is some of the views start saying, well, there's more than one coming. There's a coming for the church, some would say. And then some would say, well, he comes and then leaves and comes back after the millennium. And some of that's true, too. But the great white throne is at the very end of everything. So everybody does believe in a future coming of Jesus to clear this whole mess up. But the journey there is different for each of the views. All right. Thank you. Have a good summer.
Thank you for listening to the Providence Church Podcast. By subscribing to the podcast, you can keep up with the weekly preaching of Providence Church as well as other recordings. You can access any additional content such as helpful articles by following the link in the description or by visiting our website at providenceswfl.com. You can also stay up to date on these messages and others by looking us up on Facebook at Providence SWFL. Providence Church exists to glorify God by treasuring Christ, loving people, and making disciples. Thanks for listening.